noon.
Okay, can we begin? Can you guys hear us?
Yes.
We can. Now we can. Okay, let's get started and we'll go to item eight. And I'm going to ask Hank to comment on the general scope of the mediation training and manual. I view this less as a legislative issue, but Hank may feel differently, but we'll get into that. Okay?
Well, I think we can do this, solve this mediation problem as I see it by developing a court manual on policies and procedures for mediation. And what you have is you have the Spectrum Institute white paper, and the Spectrum Institute has been doing a lot of national studies on guardianship procedures. That's a great paper that I think everybody should read. And one of the main issues in the paper is about how the Americans with Disability Act applies to the court, and that the court is delegating certain responsibilities in compliance to advocate attorneys and to mediators. So I think this is pretty serious stuff, and I think we've got to pay attention to it. Then attached as an item is the Alaska Court System Adult Guardianship Conservatorship Mediation Pilot Project Policies and Procedures. And now that goes beyond just the mediation procedures. It also has requirements in there for the mediator training. And we really have to deal with mediator training. If you look at that in Policy 9, it talks about safety, balance of power, and expression of the rights of the adult, or what we'll call the protected person. And that has to be incorporated into the training to make sure that we're complying with the ADA. I drafted rules for mediation. It came out to be 25 pages because there's so much stuff you have to cover to make it understandable, not just to lawyers, but we have a lot of pro se litigants, and I thought it would be inappropriate to short circuit it so people got into mediation and they didn't understand the rules of the road. So it's just not appropriate to have a 25-page rule, and therefore I suggest that we develop a manual for mediation to include policies and procedures as to the mediation, but also as to the required training, education requirements that we're going to place on the mediators. And essentially, the Alaska manual is pretty close to what I think we'd want to do here. There's some things they do in Alaska we want to hear, but I think we can use this as a probably get 90% of what we want to accomplish. If we do a manual, then it's my sense that we can do a short form rule. And the short form rule would just define mediation, explain what it is. It would advise parties how to request mediation or provide that the court can order mediation on its own. And then it would, the short form rule would provide and direct people that wanted to get It would provide and direct people that wanted to get information about the mediation process to the court's website. And the manual would be on the website, and the manual would also be in the district court clerk's office. And then there's a component of this procedures and policies that they have in the Alaska manual, which is not in the rules that I developed, but also is a method of or a direction that the mediation be publicized, the fact that it's available. And so one of the things they did is they developed a brochure up there that's handed out. I think we could make sure that that's provided to people in the court clerk's office or some other way of distribution. So with those things in mind, I guess the question is, do we want to move that way? I think the court's probably got the ability to adopt a manual of policies and procedures, and I think it's probably the most efficient way we can go forward.
I asked Hank to, because this was originally in the rules subcommittee, but because of the issues surrounding how you approach this and whether we would use a manual in combination with a rule, I wanted the whole commission to hear the perspective and look at the material that he had generated on the topic. So I'd like to hear from commission members about the process and the procedures. I wish I'd asked Judge Walker before he left. Maybe some of you are practicing Washoe can comment on this. I know that Judge Doherty was using mediation to some degree, although looking at the statistics, it doesn't look like there's a lot of them. And I don't know, Judge Sherman, whether you and your colleagues have been resorting to mediation and how that's currently working, but.
Not through mediation, we have referrals to the senior judges.
Okay.
Through, with truly dysfunctional families, that's a better distinction of they almost always go in, they seem to really be able to communicate with me. But it's still that 1 year is not looking down. Commissioner Stewart does have a list of people who would be happy to serve as mediators from the state bar section, but it's going to need to change. So I was worried about the funding for the state bar. So, like, if they were to I'm sure they'd be happy to train. They love having you in that, so I'm sure we'd get mediators. And so, I'm here.
How do you feel as a pressure issue about adopting a manual that outlines the procedure and defines the process for the rule?
I think that's what we did with the trial and when we were doing arbitration. And this is just one more thing that you can tell people, there is a couple of people who are decentralized. And we are not very neutral. They would love to see how they
are. Jim, how about you and either Jennifer or David? What do you think about that?
Definitely in the hurricane, which would be a very valuable tool. I read through the manual and I thought it was very well put together, structured very well. So we would be in support of that.
The problem right now is usually the peer came in and outside mediator, not the clock. And that's either paid for by the petitioner or with in some cases. So due to the clock, it might not be available in every city, so unless you can figure out a way to come about that. But after reviewing the materials that have been submitted, we can also in favor of sending one to the mediation. Sometimes for them, it takes a really great opportunity for them to select a specific alternative.
All right, anybody else?
I participated in mediation and adult guardianship a number of times in all kinds of and I found it's been very helpful. I helped Judge Doherty. I did one of her trainings for guardianship mediators when she started the mediation program. And I had never had a discussion with Judge Doherty about it, but it seemed to me from my cases, the case presented on the first day in court as a family. Let's just say there was clear family static, then it almost was an automatic referral to mediation. If there wasn't a stipulation to the guardianship at that point, it's reasonable. And in every one of those cases, I think that almost all of them are very difficult cases. The mediation was either successful or put the case in a position where we walked back in court in front of the judge. It was resolved there one way or another. I think it's important that we have a manual, we have a training, and that attorneys and mediators don't just take up the practice. The nuances in guardianship, I think everyone at the table knows, are not written in the law. And we're working on getting some of those things in there. And talking with Hank about what he's proposing, I'm very in favor of it, and some of the things he's bringing up, I think that can go, well, we did that without even thinking about it. Having protected persons who are adults who may have some diminished capacity, but in every case, we try to have them in the room mediating at least at the start of the mediation for an hour, or bringing them back on subsequent mediation. And a lot of those, the seniors, a lot of those senior issues that face people under guardianship need to be addressed in a mediation as well as a court scenario. And I think a manual and a required training is essential to get people with a slightly different focus. These cases need to be a lot different than a civil case or an abusive workforce trial. So I would hope that they need to be a lot different there. And in many cases, you have more than two sides of the table. You may have a brother or sister who don't get along, and mom or dad are both under guardianship and they have their own opinion.
Anybody else have any comment about Hank's suggestion and draft? Okay, with that, Hank, what might be the most productive thing to do is to revise the list of satisfied with it in the meeting. I don't know that it fits within the scope of what you had in mind just yet.
Well, my approach would be, and I think we just adopted really, I put my place to the product,
mm-hmm.
and which would be the manual. But then the rules would be just a definition of mediation. I think I sent down to Jen, I don't know if it came out yet. The definition of mediation, what does mediation mean in the context of guardianship? To be a facilitative process, not an evaluative process. And we're going to explain how you can get to mediation and then somehow set up some kind of a system where people can get access to the manual. And I think that's only, that takes up 3/4 of a page. I think that's most appropriate than 25 pages. I just want to say one thing about the Alaska Court System project here. Two people that I met in the past, they were both past presidents of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. They, I guess they're both living in British Columbia because there's a law review online from the British Columbia Elder Law Foundation or something, and they talked about this. And both of those people opined that the Alaska system was a model system. And the Alaska system is also getting technical advice from the Center for Gerontology, which has done a lot of trainings over the years in the area of mediation. So, with everything that I've come across, I think this is the way to go. I would refer everybody to, in the Alaska Court System Manual, policy number 9, talks about safety, balance of power, protection of rights. And those are the ADA standards that I think we have to comply with. So, my sense is when this manual comes out and we have that policy in there, plus we have the training requirements for the mediators, what my hope is that we're going to have some uniformity about how these mediations are dealt with across the state. So, every mediator, all the attorneys know what we're trying to accomplish here. And if we can ask people in a least restrictive environment, if we can even divert from a guardianship and get the families on the same page, I think it's all the better. And that's what I think the manual will accomplish.
So, how did you envision getting the manual, a draft, to the committee?
I'm not going to do this. Sharon doesn't want to do it. Well, I don't know. I can redline it, and I don't know if they'll have a staff person,
Right.
And I'm getting ready to be on Sunday, but I could try and redline it, and maybe I can submit it to somebody if they'll raise their hand, and they could have. Okay. So I'll get a comment.
Okay. All right. Then let's defer this to November 2nd. And maybe if you can, by then also take a whack at a short rule that you can include in that too.
Just a question procedurally. So, with a short rule, and I'll ask some calls because I know you'll be gone for our meeting. Should we onboard that short rule into our subcommittee simultaneously with Emmanuel going to the okay? So we'll just calendar one of our next three meetings. Will you be back for?
I will be on October 24th.
Okay, Sharon, can you please make a note that we'll add the mediation rules? You okay with that, John?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm just scheduling again, John. 10:24.
All right, thank you. Thanks for that research and that input.
Different amendments for the record. Additionally, it looks like there was a list of forms that the Alaska group had used, including a request for mediation and so forth. If we included that in our forms portion of it, I think that it would help, you know, get more cases going forward towards mediation.
I'm going to send those down to Jeff.
Perfect.
If I can get it done before I leave.
Okay.
You have those, don't you?
I have them everywhere.
Yeah, there's four more forms that I'll send down here.
But hold off till you get the manual, Jim, because it doesn't make any sense till we work through that draft. Is that okay? Okay. All right. Then let's ask Sterling if there's anything else he'd like to comment about regarding the ADA proposed amendments.
CEO, I'd like to say that I certainly did outside of not only the agenda for approval at the meeting that I had. It was not. So it's not been acted on. But as I said, I thought that the chapter 5 is a chapter that would might help us address this unique issue. For example, a person did this, I think for the nursing home, the family can't come up with treatment medication, but they want to make mom medical decision. Well, that's what you do, is make this simple appointment to have.
Regarding possible revisions to the rules of appellate procedure to fast track certain guardianship issues. This doesn't require legislation. This would be a rule amendment by the Supreme Court. I think Jennifer, you initiated this idea. Is that correct?
I wish I could take credit for it, but Mr. Conlon no longer is here. Had talked that out when we were discussing appeals and reviewing issues that may have a sense of urgency. I know that I also mentioned it to Mr. Burchfield as well.
So I appreciate the importance of fast tracking them as well. So let me just make an observation. This year is facing 3,000 filings by many the highest number of filing courses ever seen in New Mexico. He said the last 3 years, we've increased our filing not by the normal 2%, but by 8 to 10%. After the first year of the Court of Appeals, the pending caseload went from 1,980 cases to 1,515. So all of us were pretty excited about the progress the Court of Appeals had. Notwithstanding the fact that the Court of Appeals has received and has decided about 950 cases in each of the next 2 years, and we'll probably do that again this year, as of August 31st, the Supreme Court pending caseload is 1,995 cases, all of which is driven by increased filing. 2,600 cases 2 years ago, 2,800 cases last year, and 3,000 cases this year. I fully respect the idea and the need and the importance of staff backing some of these issues. I don't know if there's any way to quantify the number of cases this might actually be. So that would be an important, I think, for us to think about. But I hate to have the court make promises about fast-tracking appeals when, quite frankly, you make that promise in child custody cases. So you promise to try to decide a case within 90 days after briefing, and even that is becoming a struggle today. So it may be an example of if you build it, they will come, and that seems to be what's happening. And it's a rather terrifying prospect, frankly, about where we are at the appellate level. I'm really concerned about it. Doesn't mean I'm not open to the idea, but I think we need to quantify this in quite a bit. So maybe, Jim, if you could work with Jennifer on this a little bit and maybe refine the types of issues that are you perceive to be super important that need prompt review. I know in the sterilization, it wasn't a sterilization case, it was a, I'll call it a right to die or not die case out of Washington County. The court expedited the review of that case because of the nature of the emergency that existed. So we handled it under the court's emergency statute, their emergency statute, under the fellow procedure. But I just see an issue. I don't know about temporary guardianship. I don't think the court's going to want to be engaged in reviewing district court judges' temporary guardianship decisions. That I think we've already had that conversation before. But I can see where there are medical issues or life-death issues that arise in this context. There may be an appellate review, a prompt appellate review, or needed if possible. But I want to also caution that the business court wants us to fast-track business court cases. You know, whatever practice area you're in, they want us to act faster, and so the answer won't necessarily be by putting in a rule and actually do it. So I'm very reticent to put more rules in the appellate procedure that provide the fast-track and then not meet the promises that we made them to do that. Now, that said, I do want to call everyone's attention. An ADKC has been filed by Justice Pickers and I, which we might want to consider incorporating here. We were proposing an amendment to the rules of civil procedure that would, that would say that in cases in which there is an order granting or denying an order for a motion for summary judgment, or in cases in which there is an order granting a 12b-5 motion, that the court would review that, those issues as we currently do in venue cases, based upon the pleadings that are filed in the district court only. Unless the court orders further briefings. To us, this makes sense. The Supreme Court reviews orders granting or denying motions for summary judgment basically on the basis of the same standards used in the district court. So why should we allow the parties, or require the parties, probably a better way of saying it, to spend more money just to regurgitate and rewrite everything that they told the district court judge? And that's particularly true in the 12B context, 12B5 as an example. Why should we rewrite everything that we told the district court judge? Why not just review what the district court judge reviewed, determine whether the law supports that decision or doesn't, and move on? And it's possible that that's a vehicle that could be used in these very narrow circumstances. So I commend that idea to you, that I came to you, and you might want to look at that, Jim and Jennifer, and see whether or not it's something that may work in this context. It isn't, I don't know whether it's appropriate for us to review a district court's decision, for example, in a serialization case, on the same papers that were filed in the district court, but on the other hand, why not? By the way, I happen to believe that the rules we're proposing in our agency team, Justice Sibley and I, will actually include these papers that are filed with the district court, because the lawyers will be on notice, and you don't get another bite at the apple, and you don't get to spend another $10,000 of your client's money improving upon what you should have done at the district court level in the first instance. So I just mentioned this to you, and maybe you can take a look at that as well.
How do you do this?
Okay, great.
I did have one comment, Mr. Farsi. In the prior guardianship commission, in one of the meetings, we had sort of asked generally, why aren't we seeing these issues on appeal? You know, the things that people were coming in public comment. And I think that sometimes it's not the underlying subject matter that that is the urgency. I think it's the age and the medical condition of this kind of person. So we have a lot of, for example, all the respective services services that sort of, you know, fizzle out because now it's gone from being a personal crime to being a property crime where they have to live. And so I think there's a chilling effect on the willingness of people to file appeals, knowing that they're never, that, you know, that the next person is going to have to live in the interim. So it's not that the underlying appealable issue has to do with their passing or anything like that, but you're about to lose an active controversy that would be helpful or instructive. So I think the briefing idea is a unique one that would allow it to be offered in those cases, and then you try to be able to court to have a look at it and get some, because there's inconsistency obviously across jurisdictions and how some of these issues are handled. So you're not getting law and guardianship because it sort of dies with the person and that's a problem.
Or you might participate in the conversation with Jennifer and Jim and see if there's something you'd like to suggest out and defer this to the November 2nd meeting, and maybe you guys can collaborate a little bit on this and see how she looks. You know, I will say, in many cases, it's a pretty what always ticks me off is the fact that the party settled the damn case. We could take a whole lot more law if people stop settling their cases. But I I think what happens is the realization that we might actually rule under because it's incredible.
Cost is also a factor.
Cost is a factor, and that's why our approach to this briefing is important. I mean, I don't know, let me ask this Buckley again. What do you think some of the lawyers down there would charge for a, let's just take a family law case with one issue of first impression? What's the appeal on that going to cost, do you think? Private counsel. What was Marshall charged? I know Marshall donates a lot of his time, but what was Marshall charged? Or what was Ed Kingman charged? Or, you know, folks like that.
A lot.
that's the point. And so, at the end of the day, we need to be mindful that the public judicial system is here for the litigants. And so we need to start doing things that reduce the litigant cost and still effectively justice when we can. And that's why these ideas are here in the
book. I am just going to make a comment, and I don't really have a team at this point either way. I think we can make access to justice and release more statistics is good, especially in guardianships where things do happen very quickly. But I will note that it, at least in my experience, there's not briefing. But there's really no briefing that the Supreme Court can rely on. We are literally standing in court, especially in the third party petition context, because we aren't allowed to see anything that's filed and relevant as evidence until the public guardian is appointed because of HIPAA. So there's no way to brief anything. So it really is flying by the seat of your pants. And then an order comes out, but the order may not make findings or capture the entirety of what happened. And then, of course, the only record is a video. So logistically, I wonder how insightful that process would be in allowing the appellate court to make a decision without the benefit of actually briefing an issue like residency or something like that. So I would observe that in my 10 years, I rarely write anything down.
I'm
going
to do an anecdotal situation that I've had in a jurisdiction here. An ex parte temporary guardianship was granted. No one's going to notice. I got the case. To the guardian and say, oh, well, what's going on? What happened? What's the emergency? What's the situation? Oh, nothing. Everything's fine. We didn't even ask for that. They just knew that at the courthouse and filled out the paper. And there's nothing attached. There's no findings. And in those situations where there's no findings being made, what's the remedy? What remedy would you just feel, right? But how do we change the conversation about what a temporary guardianship looks like versus what a full guardianship looks like without that mechanism? And
a direct appeal only can be filed in the context of a final order that adjudicates all the parties' interests, unless there's a 54B certification. So there have been a few issues presented to us recently by extraordinary writ. I don't know whether we would entertain extraordinary writ, where there was a temporary guardianship granted, and when the issue had to do with the basis for the OLED standards that have been met. But generally speaking, we consider extraordinary writ that there's no alternative remedy in law that's been directed to it. So the first leg might be satisfied in that area. So there are ways to reach the Supreme Court with unusual issues that have, for which there are conflicts in jurisdictional approach. One of the reasons we entertain this is when people demonstrate in their petition that different courts are handling it in different ways. And that comes up fairly frequently. When that's brought to our attention, that's an eye catcher, and oftentimes the justices on this court are very interested in clarifying conflicts that exist in the law. This came up several times in the context of the HOA foreclosure case, where we saw a lot of writ petitions because there were differences of opinion among the district court judges throughout the state about how particular legal issues should be handled. So there are other vehicles available to reach the Supreme Court other than fast track or certain other amendments. I will say this, though, it's not a well-kept secret that the justices, any justice on this court will see a writ petition within 48 to 72 hours. Now, what happens with that writ is another question, and whether an order can answer an order, whether an emergency release is dealt with, or another question. But staff is required to bring them to our attention. We do have cases where, like day one and day two, we'll have a split between the top and the list and something gets missed. But by and large, we adhere to that practice. So many of these cases, those risks involve quite a bit of urgency. And with them comes an emergency motion. Okay, let me just ask Ms. Buckley, I'm going to ask James to comment on this too. But Ms. Buckley, I wanted you to share with the Commission the initiative that you've undertaken calling for full representation of children, 100% representation of children, and how that might extend or apply to the minor guardianship area.
Child is separated or brother is separated.
You'll keep this updated?
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Now, is this something here at Jennifer, you know, is this something James is working on in Marshall as well?
Yes, I think that the years are on it. They are starting to work with us, starting to go along with them.
I have met with Mr. Conway a few times and have several discussions with him regarding the appointment of attorneys and the minor guardianship cases. So we have developed a referral process to streamline and determine which cases are most appropriate for them to be able to represent.
Okay. But it's interesting to know what case type you all are focusing on, and maybe you can share that information with probably if you're not already doing that, and collaborate on how you all see that. Maybe the jurisdiction for a different case type, I don't know, but it would be interesting to see if they're, how they compare.
Absolutely, I will be talking to you.
Okay. All right, or Linda, maybe okay. Is there any public comment in Clark County, Jeff Sherman? Any public comment in Carson City? Okay. Does any commissioner have anything they'd like to raise or ask about before we adjourn today? Okay, then we'll all make a clean getaway and we'll all be there. Thank you for your time.
I'm talking about that.